I do, but.
Or you could say you're related.
We will. Of the Subcommittee on Natural Resources of Joint Ways and Means. We are in order. Today's agenda, we have a public hearing on the Department of Land Conservation and Development. I will call a public hearing to order on Senate Bill 5527. And would the department please come up? Would you care to?
Is there anything we need to
background? Sure, I'll just give you a real quick background. Co-chair Witt, members of the subcommittee, just real quick for DLCD, we took a look at the agencies at the current service level. There are some things you might be aware of. There were quite a few one-time only funding or programs that were phased out going into 17-19 with about $888,000 worth of general fund programs, including funding for the Southern Oregon Regional Pilot Program, completion of the agency's information management modernization initiative, $100,000 general fund that was given to fund House Bill 4079, establishing a affordable housing pilot project, and $300,000 general fund that was originally slated for a SAGECON coordinator position in the agency. As far as the governor's budget goes, the governor's budget takes about a net $500,000 reduction from the current service level agency of the budget. And that was accomplished through about $1 million reduction overall from CSL, and then an add back of $500,000 that provided grant funding for local planning activities of about $250,000, $100,000 in federal expenditure authority for natural resource or natural hazards mitigation planning, and a reestablishment of a planner position to work on coastal resilience and hazard mitigation at a cost of roughly $250,000 in general fund. As far as other issues, DLCD does continue to be subject to a 30% reduction in grant funding for coastal zone management from NOAA due to disapproval of Oregon's coastal non-point source pollution program by the EPA due to ongoing concerns with riparian protection permitted under the Oregon Forest Practices Act. And the agency is just getting ready to publish their report on House Bill 4D79 implementation. We should be seeing that shortly.
Thank you very much. And I'm going to ask the department if they just stand at ease for a moment. I'd like to give Representative Lewis an opportunity to introduce himself. Welcome to our committee.
Thank you. I just took place of Representative Vic Gilliam, who had to resign for health reasons. And I was appointed, approved by the Marion and Clackamas County Commissioners last Wednesday and was sworn in last Thursday. So my background is law enforcement, just short of 40 years, and 28 years as a police chief in three different cities. And I was appointed or elected mayor in Silverton in 2014 and served as mayor, and I just resigned that position before I was sworn in last Thursday. So that's my background, and I'm happy to be here.
We're most happy to have you. Thank you very much, Representative Lewis. Department folks, welcome. Please proceed.
Thank you, co-chairs, members. Special welcome to the former mayor of the greatest city in the state of Oregon, home of my family for 111 years. So welcome.
Thank you.
We are going to be spending the better part of the next 3 days, or at least part of the next 3 days, with you. First of all, for the record, Jim Rue, director.
Carrie McLaren, deputy director of the department. Thank you.
So we've met with all of you. We've had conversations a little bit about this presentation and our budget. Most of you, with the exception of Senator Taylor, have not sat in this well. Rep Helm as well has been here before. But we're probably new to many of you. And so I'm going to start out by just asking you to think about two particular issues during the course of these next 3 days as we present. The first one is something that is perhaps of some dispute in the state of Oregon, but we insist that all planning is local. Planning happens in local cities and counties around the state of Oregon. We don't do much planning at DLCD. We administer a program that has 19 goals that are overarching over the planning requirements of each of those 242 cities and 36 counties. But the real planning happens in county seats and cities around the state, in the planning departments of local government. We certainly provide resources. We provide technical assistance. We provide some very small amount of money that helps planning happen, but we do insist that while it certainly is a cooperative effort, that the real work of planning for the future of Oregon cities and counties is the purview of local government. The second question that I'd like you to keep in mind as we talk is just to try to answer the question of why we even do this. Why do we plan? 44 years ago, sometime in early May, SB 100 passed the legislature. It was a sort of unique coalition of farmers and loggers and environmentalists that proposed and then eventually passed the statewide planning program. So many of the roots of this program exist in protection of working farms and forests, as well as protection of natural resource values. And I would say that for much of the early history of this program, of the department, that is, that's where our focus was. We didn't spend a lot of time worrying about what happened inside of the urban growth boundaries. And in the last 6 or 7 years, we've made a very intentional pivot to try to balance the program and to spend a fair bit of time also helping local communities do planning inside of the UGB. We're going to talk a lot about some of those efforts in the next couple of days. We're also going to talk about a process that Kerry headed to fundamentally streamline the entire UGB process. It is different today than it was just over 2 years ago when the legislature passed the reform bill. And then the last reason that we plan is to protect local communities against hazards, whether that's tsunami or landslide or flood. We spend a lot of time working with local governments to prepare them for resiliency. And that's a word that we toss around a lot, being resilient. But I kind of tend to think about it in terms of human health. If we're generally healthy, we can fight off the cold that Carrie's had for 6 weeks. But we can generally resist and get back to good health quickly. And we have a lot of communities around this state that are looking at the potential for a fairly severe assault. And we all know about the Cascadia event that we're all thinking about, or many of us, much of the time. But it comes in other forms of natural disaster. And so that is the third part of where we spend an awful lot of our time. So if you will indulge me by simply thinking about those two things over the course of the next couple of days, I'd be grateful. So depending upon how we do in terms of timing, I think we'll do the first two tabs today. We'll probably spend most of our time talking about what it is that the department does, what we have done, what we propose to do. And then the we're going to forget about the appendices, and we'll do the green and whatever other color that is the budget issue probably tomorrow. We may finish a little early today. It's going to be up to you whether we jump into the second half or whether we just pick it up in the morning. And that, again, is going to be your choice. So I just went over that. So let's just skip ahead, if we may. As you'll see in a later slide, we have agreements with most of the agencies of state government, as well as a couple of federal agencies, because of the number of things that we get involved in. The core of the program, particularly for cities, is to ensure that every community has a 20-year land supply, or land supply to ensure 20 years of job growth and housing growth. Outside of the UGB, as we said earlier, we're really focused mostly on farms and forests. Some of you from more rural parts of the state, and Representative Esquivel is probably one of those people who has talked about this in, to us personally and certainly in the past, is there are parts of this state that simply are not productive farm or forest land, period. And yet that land is treated as though it is exclusive farm use in many cases. We're going to talk a little bit about some of the efforts that we're currently undertaking to look at possibly some changes to how we think of those so-called non-resource lands. But we'll get to that a little later. I guess what I would point out is that the three spheres that are on the right side, our focus is on economic development, on that nexus between transportation and planning, because after all, that's where cities usually are, is where roads and rivers and railroads all come together. So there is just this indisputable link between how we plan transportation and how we plan cities. And then, of course, the housing issue, one that is a subject of many of the conversations around this building right now, making sure that we have sufficient housing. We have been through I have one more. Okay. Why do we do what we do? Well, we do it because you all have directed us to do it. We have a governor who has directed us in certain projects, and we have a commission, a 7-member volunteer commission. So we are staffed to that commission. And we've talked a little bit about this. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on that second bullet. But yes, we're about enhancing urban and rural communities. We're going to talk a little bit later about poverty and about jobs, problems that exist in two fairly divergent parts of this state. Rural communities in this state have not yet recovered from the recession. And a focus on job development in rural communities is key to what we're going to be doing in the next couple of years, has been for the last couple. There are also deep pockets of poverty in urban areas around the state. One that comes to mind is that portion of East Portland, east of 205, where there are some 65,000 people who live in poverty. And we have been working with the Regional Solutions Program in Portland in the metro area to begin to address that. The arrival of Amazon and several thousand good starter wage jobs coming into that neighborhood in the next couple of years is going to be huge, plus whomever may follow. But we'll, again, spend some more time on that in a bit. Rural and rural community assistance, some grants. We're going to talk about what we've done with those grants and what we might do with grants in the next biennium. The governor's recommended budget has diverted all of our general fund grant money to local governments to the coast for coastal seismic resilience, but it's a conversation that we clearly want to have with you. So I'm going to, because I'm probably talking too much, I'm going to skip over this slide and the next slide if you're driving, Carrie, because we've pretty much talked about this stuff, and introduce you to our commission. So from left to right, excuse me, Bart Eberwine is a senior vice president, excuse me, with Hoffman Construction in Portland. He's the guy with the helmet with the big H on it. Jerry Lids is a semi-retired lawyer from Eugene, spent a fair bit of his career with the Department of Justice. Catherine Morrow is a retired Deschutes County planning director who now she and her husband spend their summers in a lookout just outside of John Day. They spend their summer as smoke watchers. Greg McPherson in the middle, a name known to many of you in this body, is our chair. Greg is a retired lawyer from Salem and the son of Hector McPherson, who was one of the co-sponsors of the original legislation. Melissa Cribbins, Coos County Commissioner, is next. Also a practicing lawyer. Former general counsel to the Coquel tribe in southwest Oregon. Sherman Lamb is a tax attorney, but also has his degree in viticulture and enology from UC Davis, and spent 20 years growing grapes and making wine in Jackson County. And then Robin MacArthur is on the far right. Robin is the just retired director of planning for Metro, but was also Governor Kitzhaber's natural resources advisor at one time, as well as an advisor to Matt Garrett at ODOT. So she knows this program and planning very well. We, in the governor's recommended budget, try to align directly with the governor's areas of or governor's initiatives, and we fit most easily under that area known as responsible environmental stewardship. But as we've talked about, and we're going to talk about a lot, an awful lot of our effort goes into the thriving statewide economy. And then just to give you a very brief overview structurally of who we are, the commission you just met on the far left, the department in the middle, we have four divisions within the department. So the first one, the Ocean and Coastal Services Division, is Oregon's coastal zone authority. So all of those things that come under federal purview from NOAA, from the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, get carried out in the coastal zone by our coastal division. Our planning services division, for the most part, is federally funded, does a lot of the hazards work that I talked about, but they also share a program with ODOT called Transportation Growth Management. It's federal highway money that comes to ODOT and then is jointly administered by ODOT and ourselves. Our community services division consists of primarily our regional representatives, eight of them scattered around the state, but also some specialists here in Salem and in our Portland offices who support them, and then our administrative services division, which supports us all and keeps us all running. I'm going to stop for a moment, and Carrie's going to talk a little bit about our strategic planning process, which she began shortly after she came to the department, has now culminated in a functional strategic plan that pretty much informs everything that we do.
Thank you, Jim. So thank you, co-chairs Frederick and Witt and members of the committee. When I joined the department in 2012, one of the areas that Jim asked me to spend some attention to was taking a longer view, both in terms of our budget and programmatic work for the department. And we decided to adopt and basically look at it an 8-year framework for developing the strategic plan. A challenge there, as Jim talked with you about, is so much of what the department delivers is technical assistance to local governments in planning processes that they initiate. And so in that sense, we are really reactive to the needs and desires and requests of local government. But at the same time, out of those needs, requests, we have a sense of where issue spots are that are hitting more than one community. So whether it's an issue of affordable housing or needs to update their comprehensive plans or needs for better scientific data to support local hazard planning. And so that's what really what our strategic plan endeavored to do, was to reflect both the core work, that technical assistance and plan review that we do, but also to set a direction for some planning development that the department could do. It's organized in a way that tries to synthesize the 19 state planning goals. So some of them, obviously, those that are, apply to the coast and coastal shorelands don't affect Malheur County, but many of them do are goals and values that are shared statewide, whether it's for affordable housing, transportation linkages, protection of natural and historic resources. And so we lumped these into goals that sort of look more at around conservation values, economic development and housing development, supporting our local governments through technological needs, et cetera. As we went through that process, and I will say, you know, there's a number of different ways one can head into strategic planning, all of them good, but we really took a streamlined view and tried to coalesce the work that we were presently doing and work with our commission and our advisory committees to review the plan. And we came across, I would say, 5 main goals that our department is endeavoring over this 8-year period. One is to expand the capacity for outreach and education for technical assistance in the planning work that we do. How this might look is the development of model codes and ordinances that cities can adopt in whole or in part, or just use as frames of reference for work that they want to do. Increasing community and economic development assistance to rural communities, working primarily with the regional solutions team. And that's a team that can be easily deployed. It resides in the community. We have a full-time staff person in each of the regional solutions centers. Can really build those local relationships and work cross-department on issues related to housing, transportation, needed public infrastructure, et cetera. A third area, and we've accomplished much in this, is to streamline the urban growth boundary process by adopting new alternative rules that are more reliable in terms of a city's ability to get through the urban growth boundary amendment process. But also then to hopefully take some time away from that long-range planning about where the UGB should land and focus really on what can cities do inside of that. So how do we endeavor as part of that planning process to focus on planning for affordable housing, planning for transit, planning for parklands, planning for economic development in those communities. The fourth area was to create resilient communities and mitigate the effects of natural hazards, tsunami, and climate change. And really, you'll hear a lot in our presentation about tsunami, but also about landslides and wildfires and what the state can do to help local governments have local hazard mitigation plans to make sure that they're prepared in the event of a natural disaster. And finally, and critically, to improve the capacity both at the department level and then in service for local governments to gather, analyze, and distribute data that local governments can use for their planning exercises and that we can rely upon for our planning exercises. So a couple of examples that I would just give you there. I'm very thankful for the legislative support in some research that helped support both our urban growth boundary streamlining process and our more recent affordable housing project to show us what communities across the state were cost burdened, where did we need to target these rules so that we had the most effect of building more affordable housing resources on the ground. That data then can become available to local governments as well for their planning exercises. The last thing I would say is we took then this work from the strategic plan and used it through a process that had begun through the Department of Administrative Services to work on performance management. So our strategic plan sets out what we aim to do and how we aim to do it. Performance management system tells us how we're doing. And there is in your appendix, Appendix D, it's called the fundamentals map. And those work processes really flow from our strategic plan. And we have measures that we grade ourselves on in terms of how well are we doing with reviewing comprehensive plans? How well are we doing in providing customer service to our local citizens? Do they view our work on their technical advisory committees as being a help in the adoption of that process? We meet quarterly as staff to report to ourselves and where we find ourselves faltering or not meeting the grade that we would like. We ask ourselves why and what we can do to improve that process. So that has been sort of, I think, part of the department's evolution and really trying to make sure we're a small budget, we have a large mission. How are we really managing those resources to the greatest output?
I would just add one quick thing about the performance management system. If you do take a look at it, you will see at the bottom of the first page that we have 11 outcomes, and those are our outcome measures. We also have some performance measures that tell us how we're doing in terms of support activities, but the legislature in the past has also given us key performance measures, so-called KPMs. You've been through them with other agencies who've preceded us here. Sometimes those KPMs are a good measure of what we do. Sometimes they're not so good. And over time, I think we'd like to have the conversation with you about how we begin to substitute some of our performance measures, our outcome measures, in place of some of the key performance measures that may or may not work so well. Because we've tried to, in this performance management system, be very clear-eyed about what we should be doing and how we're doing in terms. We're, as Carrie said, we're grading ourselves on a quarterly basis. So moving on, we've talked about this a fair bit in terms of working with cities, counties, other state agencies, the federal government. We haven't talked a lot about tribal governments. Most of the 9 tribes in the state of Oregon have some version of land use planning for themselves. And so we think of them as sovereign governments who are sort of sisters. And we work with them, but we do not have any direct authority over how planning happens on tribal lands. The last two, the Citizens Involvement Advisory Committee and the Local Officials Advisory Committee, are, volunteer citizen committees that report directly to LCDC, to our commission. Goal one is citizen involvement, and so CIAC, or CIAC, advises the commission on how to more effectively gather and put citizen input into the process. The LOAC, the Local Officials Advisory Committee, are three electeds from counties, county commissioners, and three electeds from cities, either mayors or council people. And we meet 4 to 5 times a year. Frankly, it's one of the best meetings I go to because where we sit in a room with our chair and with staff, and we talk directly to the electeds of local government about what's working and what's not, and what we can do better. The next slide is Carrie talked very briefly about regional solutions. I'm sure you all know what regional solutions are, but perhaps for the benefit of Rep. Lewis, I'm going to start at the very basic. Regional solution centers are scattered around the state, as you can see here. They are exactly coincident with the economic development districts all around the state. They work very closely with those economic development districts. In fact, in Medford, they're co-housed with SoReady, the Southern Oregon Regional Economic Development District. Many of them are housed at universities or community colleges. So Eugene, U of O, Central Oregon OSU Cascades, LeGrand is at Eastern Oregon University, Metros is at PSU, and the Northwest region is at Tillamook Community College. And so we are co-located with the regional staffs of ODOT, Business Oregon, DEQ, Housing, and ourselves. And in a perfect world, when it comes to economic development, DLCD is sometimes at the very point of the spear, making sure that communities have that 20-year land supply for job growth. Business Oregon comes along with their Infrastructure Finance Authority to make sure that there are sewers and water and lights and sidewalks in those economic development areas. ODOT is without a doubt the largest infrastructure provider in the state. DEQ has some clean water infrastructure money. So the point is that these five agencies are focused on economic development throughout the state of Oregon. Housing, obviously, is the other part of the equation, making sure that the people who are working in those communities have a place to live. And so this map shows those economic development districts and where our regional solutions centers are. This slide and the next slide, I think we're just going to go through quickly. Here are all of the agencies of state government. It goes one and a half columns, one plus. We have so-called coordination agreements with every one of them. Many of them need to be updated. In fact, there is a bill kicking around somewhere on the House side that would require us to update our coordination agreements with all of these agencies, and frankly, we're in need of it because it kind of ends up going to the bottom of our policy agenda. And maybe if we had somebody telling us we had to do it, we'd be a little better about getting it done. A couple of federal agencies, four, NOAA, FEMA, U.S. Fish and Bureau of Land Management, we work with on a regular basis. So, again, I'm going to skip this slide. We've talked about it a little bit. I'm going to skip the next slide because we have, for the most part, talked about that and jump into some results. What this chart shows is that Oregon is very conservative in how we use land for urbanization, particularly. So our population has been increasing sort of in the middle of these western states. Idaho is the fastest growing. California is lagging. Oregon and Washington are pretty much the same. And this is old data, really. As you can see, it's 2000 to 2010. So Washington is our closest comparable. So that population growth in Oregon has been provided in 2.3% less land, roughly a third less land than Washington, a tiny fraction of the amount in Idaho. That translates to sprawl. And this is a deeply political subject, but if I were to take you out to Ontario, Oregon right now, and you were to stand on the west side of the Snake River and then go to the east side of the Snake River, you would see dramatically different kinds of development. Now, Rep. Bentz will tell you that that is part of what is strangling Malheur County. It is an open argument. But clearly, the land use system in Oregon works very differently than it does in surrounding states. We use land at a fraction of the rates of some of our sister states. And you can see, at the same time, population per square mile, that evil density word, is noticeably higher in Oregon than it is in Washington, Idaho, or California. So those are the direct results. Again, a politically contentious issue, to be sure, but one that we think confirms that we're doing what we're supposed to be doing. So let's talk about some specifics.
Just a moment.
Yes.
Please, Senator Girard.
You said it was contentious, and I think you probably stumbled on the right word. But for those of us in rural Oregon, and you know that rural Oregon is really suffering, the land use laws are so constrictive out in a lot of those areas. And if you want to use Ontario as an example, a lot of businesses are moving across the bridge because of land use. So I'm having a hard time thinking that's a success. I understand in the Valley a different set of land use laws, but when you go east of the mountains, it gets I don't understand that. So to measure that as a success, I can't swallow that.
Okay. Co-Chair Frederick, Co-Chair Witt, Senator Girard, thank you. Excellent question point. So I've spent days, weeks in Malheur County over the last couple of years, responding particularly to the concerns of Rep. Bentz about economic development. When I was a kid, and that was a very long time ago, the Treasure Valley was the finest and most prosperous farmland in much of the country. And in fact, excuse me, my roommate at Boys State was a farm kid from Treasure Valley, and they were thriving at the time. And so preserving that agricultural base, particularly in Malheur County, has been really critical. It is a agriculturally based economy. You're quite right, particularly in the last couple of weeks with all of the damage from the snowstorms. People have been picking up and saying, we're just going to get out of Oregon. Oregon is not friendly to business. We're going to go to Idaho. We are going to be sending somebody out to Malheur County probably in the next couple of weeks as people start to rebuild, because it's just simply not true. Most of those onion sheds are perfectly legal, and we absolutely want to retain them in Oregon. And so we want to spend some time working with local governments, disabusing them of the notion that Oregon is unfriendly to business. We want them to stay, we want them to grow, and we as an agency are making a personal commitment to do that. Well, you and I can disagree about this a lot, because we have in the past, and we will. But preserving land for productive ag is at the core of our mission.
Just follow up?
Please.
I've had these discussions, as you, the audience probably knows, but, preserving class 1 and 2, 3 soils, I fully understand, but when we're talking about being able to build a house on for the kid of the family on a cattle ranch, and you don't have adequate land, and they don't meet the codes to do it, then I think it's getting kind of ridiculous out in such places as I own and some of the rural parts in eastern Oregon. So but don't get me wrong, I think agricultural land, prime agricultural land, we do need to to, but there is extremes. When you reach the extremes, as in my opinion, your organization has or your agency has, then that's when the problems exist.
A question probably continued for another day, but
okay.
We fully understand your perspective. We hear it a lot.
I'm sure you do, because he lives in my district, so I know he does.
I hear it from my brother a lot.
Representative Esquivel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The situation in the Ontario region is more of a combination of points, I feel. Let's say I had 100 acres in Oregon, in Ontario, and I had 100 acres over in Payette. Well, we're growing onions both on the 100 acres. But in Oregon, you pay a higher price for your labor. You pay a higher price for your sick leave. But yet, when we harvest those and sell them, we sell them to the same individual that pays the same price. And I think that's why a lot of people are vacating, and that's what they're talking about not being good for business in Oregon. And if you thought about it that way, you'd think, yeah, I get it.
Representative Esquivel, if you had to build an onion shed in either state, which one's easier to build the onion shed in?
I wouldn't build an onion shed in either state. I don't like onions.
Okay.
All right. Moving on. So I'm not sure that we haven't already pretty much discussed this. I think Alexis Taylor has been here and talked to you about, I'm watching the clock and we still have a few pages to go. I don't know that we need to spend an awful lot of time talking about the economic consequences of productive ag and forestry in the state of Oregon. They're obviously key. And regularly rate in the top four or five. I would point out the second bullet. We've been working very closely with the Oregon wine growers over the last 3 or 4 years, and in fact, we just came up with some new guidance, particularly for Southern Oregon wineries on the so-called activities on wineries. You know that people love to go visit the winery for tastings. But there are activities that occasionally on those wineries start interfering with surrounding farmland. I have a personal story, which I won't recount, but weddings on farmland are sometimes a real dicey proposition. Because it is a couple's perfect day that can very easily be ruined by a combine or a cultivator or a manure spreader. So we're very concerned about what happens with potential conflicts of right to farm and farming activities and what happens on some of these wineries. So we've worked very closely with the Oregon wine growers, and we've come up with what we think are a set of guidelines that they're happy with. We hope it prevents some of these conflicts from happening. Carrie, do you want to talk a little bit about the emergency storage facilities?
Yeah, so the other part I would add is these two examples were sort of provided to show how we provide technical assistance, maybe from a state perspective, to help out those conflicts. Or here we have a pressing need on the coast in some areas to make sure that communities can have their emergency supplies out of the tsunami inundation zone. Forest lands are typically under the state planning goals and in counties codes protected for commercial forest uses. But here, in balancing those interests between natural hazards and the need for community preparedness and forestry, we worked with both the forest industry and with counties and cities to make sure that we identified appropriate appropriate places for a location and an easy path forward for communities to do that. So a small example, but an example of the kinds of changes we make over time to meet new local planning needs.
So the next slide, Matt Stainer mentioned in his opening report that we have gotten a 30% reduction in a grant, a $2 million grant from National Marine Fisheries, NOAA, because of conflicts about Forest Practices Act. The reduction is on both ourselves and DEQ over a third-party lawsuit relating to the Forest Practices Act and the adequacy of protecting non-fish-bearing streams. It is an ongoing issue. Obviously, we're not directly involved. We're just part of the collateral damage. But it does have an effect on our ability to do what we need to do in the coastal zone, and we continue to stay in conversation. The second bullet, sage grouse, I think is probably one of our great successes of the last couple of years. Richard Whitman, who many of you know, either as my predecessor at DLCD or as the governor's natural resources advisor, pulled together a collaborative that worked for 2+ years to forestall a listing of sage grouse in 7 counties in eastern Oregon. And we were successful in doing that. Jerome Rosa is sitting at the back of the room, the executive director of the Oregon Cattlemen's Association. We were successful largely because we worked with landowners, particularly cattlemen, and other private and public landowners throughout those 7 counties to come up with cooperative agreements so that that we could forestall the listing. There was a bumper sticker tagline kicking around for the last couple of years that said, "What's good for the herd is good for the bird." And it was this cooperative relationship with private landowners as well as the federal government that prevented a listing of the bird in 11 western states. Again, some of us might disagree about whether or not it was needed or that it was the right path, but we absolutely believe that forestalling that listing allowed for much greater flexibility on the part of private landowners. National flood insurance, many of you who are from local government have connections to local government, particularly cities in the state of Oregon. We've been having conversations with you about the so-called FEMA biop, a biological opinion by National Marine Fisheries to the Federal Emergency Management Administration about regulating activities in the flood zone. We have been advocating for this. This was a biological opinion from one federal agency to another. Our role is advocating for local governments to make sure that whatever happens with this biological opinion can get affected without too much disruption, particularly to coastal cities, but also cities all around the state. We're not done by any means, but it continues. Want to give me a break for a while, Carrie?
Sure. So coastal resiliency.
Just before before you get too far into this, Representative Esquivel.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Do we have any inventory of how many acres that we gained on the juniper? Because the juniper seems to be a major problem with the sage grouse and with the cattle and with the mule deer habitat, because of its extraction of water out of the area. We were told in Ag and Natural Resource 2 years ago that it was 150,000 acres a year it was gaining on us out of 10 million acres. If that's the case, do we know how many acres we've just combated?
Senator Frederick, Representative Witt, Representative Esquivel. The short answer is I don't have a number for you. The Nature Conservancy, other private landowner organizations are working aggressively for exactly the reason that you just said. For those of you who aren't familiar with this water ecology of Central and Eastern Oregon, those what some people think of, I've frankly begun to see them as a pretty ugly weed. The junipers just suck the water out of the soil, and therefore so impoverish the soil that it is readily vulnerable to a whole range of other invasives, cheatgrass and a whole bunch of other stuff that is frankly the primary reason for loss of habitat for the sage grouse. So federal agencies, local agencies are working to remove as many of those acres of juniper as can be done, but I don't have a number. It's an ongoing effort because it is the primary threat, that and wildfire.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. We talked a little bit about regional solutions. Oh, am I?
Yeah,
I'm sorry,
okay.
I skipped ahead.
That's okay. And I can take this one if you
want. Why don't you go
okay.
ahead?
So turning, I guess, from inland to the coast, a few areas that are within our ocean and coastal program. One is one that we've talked a bit about in terms of helping local governments plan for the tsunami. So what we did, it was actually one of the first land use guides internationally developed for helping communities think about where they could, what efforts they could take both for evacuation routes and evacuation planning, but long-term resiliency in terms of land use planning for their communities. And so if you step through what we do is we hear a need, we then develop some, collect the data that helps to inform those cities, try to put it into one usable framework for communities, and then talk with communities if they're interested in implementing portions of the plan or doing workshops around their communities. That is ongoing on the coast in the area of tsunami planning. We also assisted the county of Tillamook in adopting a hazard overlay for Neskowin, which has really been suffering from a lot of erosion. That was a priority project for the community that we worked with them on through both grant funding and technical assistance for about 2.5 years. More in the area of coastal resiliency, as we've done mapping both with federal agencies and with other state agencies around natural hazards, so flood mapping, wildfire mapping, again, tsunami inundation zones, and the like. In Curry County, we helped the county take all of those hazards together into one framework and then help the community identify code amendments that they might want to adopt in their plans to make that development more resilient to hazards. So an obvious example, if you think about it in wildfire, what are those standards you want to have around a dwelling? Not whether or not something can happen, but how should it happen in order to make that structure and that development more resilient to the threat? We are also working through a project of special merit on an estuary inventory for the coast, working a lot with Coos County, and the outcomes and the benefits for our community are both to know more about that estuarine areas in terms of biodiversity, natural habitat protection, but also to help balance those needs for economic development around port activities. Then wave energy, I think maybe 5 years ago, people had more hopeful prospects. Some prospects on that still continue. And so in the ocean part of our program, we are working with the Pacific Marine Energy Center on a test site in federal waters south of Newport, again, to sort of test out whether or not some of this technology does present an opportunity for the state for renewable energy.
So strategic goal 2, promoting sustainable, vibrant communities. The first project on here is one that we've been working on for a couple of years in Lakeview and Lake County. It's really a cool project. A couple of airlines and the federal government, Department of Defense, have been looking for backup supplies of fuel other than pure petroleum. And so they've invested some money, and the private investors are putting together the last of the financing right now on a biojet fuels project in Lakeview. Our particular role was to do a land swap so that the community could add this facility into the UGB. The project we have high hopes for will take slash and other material out of the woods, use it as the raw material for a biofuel processing specifically to meet the quality requirements of the military for jet fuel. The added advantage to the local government here is that Lakeview is regularly in non-attainment for particulate haze from all of the wood-burning stoves in the community. They do not have natural gas. If this facility goes in, a natural gas trunk line will come from the Malin pipeline into the city of Lakeview and provide cleaner air for everybody in the community. So it's an economic development project, but it's also a community health project that we're hoping gets wrapped up pretty quickly. Carrie talked to the lawyer who's doing the permitting this morning. They have virtually all of their permits done. I think there's one outstanding. But right now, it's waiting for the financing to get wrapped up so that they can break ground and get underway. I'm going to let Carrie talk about the urban growth boundary process because she is the one who ran the rural development process that got that done.
So in 2013, our department came to the legislature with a package of two proposals, House Bill 2253 and House Bill 2254. House Bill 2253 was to provide population forecasting to contract with Portland State University to do population forecasting for the whole state. That really is the bedrock for communities doing their planning, whether it's for infrastructure planning, in some cases for schools, whether it's for employment and for housing, most certainly. And so now the cities around the state all have a cycle where they will have updated population forecasts every 4 years. That population forecasting directly feeds into a simplified urban growth boundary process, which we basically did a bunch of development research into development that has happened in the state in the last 20 to 30 years, looking at how communities grow. And one of the interesting outcomes we found was that community size actually is almost more an indicator of how a community will grow than where it is in the state. There are some regional differences, and we sussed those out. But we use that population forecasting as a way to project the need for a community for the next 14 years. That 14-year period is going to sound different than our 20-year horizon that we typically talk about, and that was through consensus of our rulemaking advisory committee to say, let's shorten that planning horizon, hoping that we can spend, again, more focus on looking at those areas which are really infrastructure ready and make sure we have those infrastructure plans in place closer in time to the adoption of the urban growth boundary, because that's what unlocks development. We can have a lot of land inside of the UGB, but if we don't have any services to that land, we can't bring it online for housing, we can't bring it online for jobs. That process took about 2.5 years of rulemaking and research. We adopted those rules just about a year ago. Communities don't actually amend their urban growth boundaries as often as we all think they do. So we have a couple of communities who are in line, the city of Newburgh and a couple of cities in Southern Oregon who are interested in the prospect but have not yet submitted an urban growth boundary amendment under that process. We're working with them to provide technical assistance to guide them. I expect we might make some changes as we learn how it's implemented, but we're looking forward to those. The next two projects that are highlighted here and shown up on the board. The first one is the Independence Landing Development Project, and I think that really brings to mind the community development and sort of downtown revitalization work that we're able to do working with local governments. You'll see the top two pictures are the renderings of what the site would look like. The The City of Independence actually just entered in November into a development agreement with a private developer to develop a 75-room hotel, 110 apartments and townhomes on a portion of this property, which really is in its downtown central core and is the connection to the river. If I toggle, you'll see a bit of an aerial of the site today. The site today is an aggregate and concrete production plant, which is now dormant. So really taking that site and reusing it for economic development for that community. The second title, the Highway 395 Economic Development Project, actually goes by a more colloquial name locally, and I will use it with their permission. The acronym is FUMIO, and they call it the five ugliest miles in Oregon. Their name, not mine. But what it really points to is a stretch of 395 that has been underutilized in terms of light industrial and some heavy industrial land. And so we did an economic analysis or commissioned an economic analysis to be looked at for that stretch to say, well, what zoning changes might you need to make? What transportation improvements might you need to make? What kind of branding could you do to actually make this place be an attractant? And I'm pleased to report that the project has a lot of support locally. The project leaders at the local level are working with ODOT to think about improvements to the street access control so that they can have better both safety and truck access in and out of that area. So this is a project that we think we can emulate in some other underutilized, more rural economic development, strip developments leading into communities, but has been a real real asset for that community.
And another one. We spent a little time talking with Rep. Power about this on Friday in her community in Milwaukee, Oregon. It's illustrative of a process that we have used to great success in the little community of Donald and Lafayette, some other communities around the state. So we often find that communities are lacking a vision of just how they can get from where they are to where they want to be. And so we have some quick response money, we have some transportation growth management money that we can use to kind of seed a project. And I think we spent about $50,000 on this Milwaukee project. But what was more important was that there's a professor at U of O in the planning school by the name of Rick Stevens, and he brings his second year planning students in, and then with some technical assistance from other members of the community, they do what's called a charrette. They bring community members in often on a Saturday morning or sometimes for a full day, and sit around and literally start graphing out on paper neighbors' desires for their community, what they would like to see. This planning charrette, it's a word that's borrowed from architecture, where the architect sits down and asks you, as the owner of the new building, just exactly what it is that you want it to look like, how you want it to function, make sure that you're going to be happy living there once it's built. And so this is the process of getting local community members to literally start mapping out their future. We then commit that to a series of drawings and are then able to give it to the city, the county, whomever, and in a perfect world can help them again with some of the funding for implementation. But it is that ground up planning that lets communities do that planning for their future that we're really proud of. Sorry?
Excuse me just a moment, please. Co-chair Frederick.
I'm going to ask that you recognize that particular approach is now being subverted by some folks, because they recognize how that charrette is actually set up, and they are doing several different things. One group I've run into this in my own community, one group shows up and basically monopolizes the charrette, because they know that's how that's going to be set up. And many of those folks happen to be planners. So just so that, I mean, I have probably more planners per capita in my district than most places.
Lucky you.
And so they show up and they know exactly how this is, yeah, this works. The other group is, frankly, some of the planners who come in, because it's often not set up in a way that is, in fact, open to ideas. It is steered. And so that can be a real problem. I run into situations, I jokingly referred this way by saying you either do nothing or you give everybody a jetpack. And then the third option is something supposedly in the middle, which is what the planners seem to have wanted all along. And people are also really on to that particular approach. So we need to be careful within this, because when it initially began, everyone said this is a good way to do something like this. But now there are folks who know how to play the game, and on both ends of the spectrum there. And I struggle with that. And when I hear of something like that taking place in my district, and we did most recently, some of you will remember a certain bridge that was being suggested. The charrettes that were set up for that were really bogus. I went to them, and I saw that was the case. So we have to be careful, because although that's a great idea, it can be gamed, and I've seen it gamed. So we need to be careful with anything like that. We need to make sure that, in fact, we are getting good information.
Thank you, Senator Frederick, because it's something that I personally have not been aware of. And what I would like to do, because we still think it can be effective, is to have a conversation with you about some of the things that we need to watch out for to make sure that it does not get subverted. So if you don't mind this being the beginning of a conversation about some things to look out for and prohibit, I would very much value that conversation.
I'd love to have that conversation. Great. So thank you.
Okay, we're really, look ahead a little bit. I think we're getting close. I just can't not talk about the next slide for a little bit, actually the one after this, this one. The first two have been legacies of everything that is wrong with the urban growth boundary process in the state of Oregon for a really long time. I hand-delivered the UGB expansion approval to the city of Bend, to city council, somewhere around November 15th or 16th. And getting Bend done and on their way was one of the primary drivers that I've been personally feeling since I became director. Carrie and another member of our staff successfully negotiated a UGB expansion for the city of Woodburn. A UGB that had been stuck for close to 10 years. So just over a year ago, in December of 15, Carrie and Rob, with a mediator, a former Supreme Court judge, a state of Oregon Supreme Court judge, worked through the issues, and all of the appellants and the city and DLCD walked home, I think, happy. You will be hearing from, I hope you're hearing from Mayor Figley from Woodburn on Wednesday when you get testimony from the community. You'll also be hearing from Brian Rankin, head of planning in Bend. What was the key? I think very simply, it was engaging fully with the communities in a conversation that got them moving in the right direction. Part of it for the city of Bend was a more modest proposal for the UGB expansion. In 2010, Bend came to the commission and wanted to expand their UGB by 8,500 acres. In November, they settled for 2,300. They can now get to work on that much-needed housing in the city of Bend, but they can also come back for another UGB expansion in 7 years, 7 to 10 years, depending upon their population growth, because of the work that Kerry did and the rest of the agency did on UGB streamlining. So where UGB expansions used to be a once-in-a-generation kind of activity, something akin to winning the lottery, UGB expansions can now happen directly in concert with population growth in a 5 to 7 to 10 year time horizon, giving communities a chance to not only get the land they need, but probably more importantly, and where Bend frankly is stuck right now, is how do we pay for the infrastructure? How do we get those pipes in the ground so that we can actually serve these new developments that are ready to go? And then I guess the very last thing I would say is the support for Planning Oregon. We have been working actually with Portland State and the University of Oregon for about the last 5 years intensely. Our UGB streamlining process actually came out of conversations that we had with faculty and students at PSU in their planning program 5 years ago. And so we've given a little bit of money and a whole lot of energy to something that we're calling Planning Oregon, which is to sit down with the academic community and begin to think about those kinds of questions that, frankly, is neither appropriate nor do we have time as a state agency to think about. But it really gives us the opportunity to start thinking about what this program will be like in 10 years or perhaps the next 40, what the challenges are, and do it with a broad collection of not only academics and students, but community interests. And we're getting a ton of value out of it, not the least of which was the streamlined UGB. So we're 6 minutes early, but if you don't mind, I think, unless Kerry, you want to talk about IMM? Just for a minute.
I think this just sort of goes to, so on one of our opening statements was that we have achieved, some of our outcomes in each one of the areas of focus under the strategic plan. And another one is to both be able to bring our information resources to local governments and to make their reporting for us easier and more efficient to do. In this last biennium, with an investment in our information modernization and management initiative, we have managed to bring all of our reporting requirements online. It was actually on Halloween. It wasn't a trick. Hopefully it was a treat, and we actually had three local governments submit that day. We're seeing about 50% of our local governments beginning to submit their applications and proposals online, which is both more efficient for them and provides more capacity for them to then dig that information back out of the system once they've given to it, both for their own record keeping and future planning activities. So I think a success for us in that regard, very modest for us, but those incremental improvements that I think help to serve local governments better.
Thank you very much. Representative Helm, question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Jim and Kerry, for being here today. With respect to the UGBs, I just want to make sure that you as a department don't take on blame that you're not responsible for. And I think you tiptoed up to it today without quite stepping over. The circumstances in Bend and Woodburn in particular, yes, they're legacy problems, and I applaud the department for being proactive in figuring out how to work through them. We, as state legislative officials, often get static from our local elected officials about urban growth boundary adjustments. And like you were saying at the beginning, we have a local planning process. That's sometimes a strength and it's sometimes a weakness. And often urban growth boundary exercises are a weakness in my mind, in that these long protracted processes of adjusting UGBs and the litigation that follows often are generated by the local government itself wanting something that is not legal at the time. And it simply takes a number of years to convince folks that they are not going to be able to expand an urban growth boundary contrary to law. So I hope my colleagues will appreciate the fact that we shouldn't, as a body, take blame for that, and you shouldn't, as a department, take blame for that. Should we help the department where we can create better processes? Yes. And I think we're now just on the verge of that with the new streamlined rules, which I hope more and more communities will take advantage of. But, you know, there's a reason that it takes 10 years to get a UGB passed, and it's mostly because there's overreaching in the case of Bend. And when folks get more reasonable at the end of a couple of rounds of litigation where they should have started in the first place, that's when we get to agreement.
Co-Chair Frederick, Co-Chair Witt, Representative Helm, thank you. All of that is true. I can't manage what happens in cities, but I can try to manage what happens within this agency. And I think there are times in the past when we have not been proactive in dealing with some of these communities early on and letting them know up front very clearly that the direction in which they were headed was probably not going to be successful, and helping them to look at alternatives. We, I think, historically have been guilty of the bring me another rock syndrome, and simply sitting back and waiting for the community to either succeed or fail. I think we have a responsibility for earlier interventions, and that was part of what I was trying to say with both Bend and Woodburn. We had representatives on the technical advisory committees in the city of Bend from the very beginning. It's a potential compromise because we are still the regulator, and so we can't be giving advice that we're then going to change our minds about when the time comes to approve or disapprove. I just think there's probably a more cooperative and better way of working than the department might have engaged in the past.
Fair enough.
Thank you.
Other questions or comments?
Jim, you mentioned a $2 million reduction in a NOAA grant. Now, I thought I heard you suggest, and this is why I'm asking the question to clarify this, that was the result, the $2 million reduction was the result of a lawsuit over non-fish-bearing streams, a private party lawsuit?
Co-Chair Witt, yes, a third party sued the National Marine Fisheries, actually sued EPA and National Marine Fisheries for failure to adequately protect stream quality in the coastal zone. So it's a section of the coast, the coastal streams in the mid-coast, that they deemed were inadequately protected from non-point source pollution. One of those was on-lot septic systems that the state was not being sufficiently rigorous in regulating, but the larger issue was the presence or absence or width of leave buffers on non-fish-bearing streams in the coastal zone.
And do we know the name of the third party?
We do. Are you asking for that?
Are you in legal proceedings with them?
We personally, Representative Witt, are not. The appellants, are working with U.S. EPA and National Marine Fisheries.
Could you tell us who the appellants are?
You know, I wish I could. It's Pacific.
No, Fred, it's, it's Northwest Environmental Advocates.
Thank you.
They sued EPA because EPA had only ever conditionally approved our state's Coastal Zone Management Act. We're the only one out of all of the states under this act who have our program disapproved.
Before the lawsuit settled.
Lawsuit has not settled.
Very interesting. Very interesting. And then, Carrie, I thought I heard you say, well, you did say, I think, that there's less enthusiasm over tidal electrical generation now than there was perhaps 5 years ago. To what would you attribute that? Would it be technology development or the allocation of testing grounds to individual private companies, or a reason I'm unaware of?
Co-Chair Witt, members of the committee, I think first and foremost, one has just been changes in terms of natural gas prices and what that has done in terms of people looking for opportunities for more lower carbon fuel and energy sources. Certainly, there have been complications connecting with the grid and just expense there. We have been part of a number of projects on the coast, and I'd be happy to bring back some more information for this committee about why those sort of test sites ended up pulling out. But I think it's a mixture broadly of natural gas, the cost of really connection for those cables, and then and the overall sort of economic environment there.
And if I may, Representative Witt, as you know, alternative supplies of energy have a very high cost early in the life cycle, and then it drops over time as they become more mature. Clearly, wave energy was at the very front of that steep cost curve. And just a little point to support Carrie's contention about the price of natural gas. On my farm, I have propane. I signed a one-year contract a little while ago for $1.57 a gallon. 3 years ago, I was paying $4.50 a gallon. And so when you have that kind of competition from a fossil fuel, it simply, there's no way to pencil out investments in something like early stage development of wave generation.
All right, thank you. And then lastly, Jim, you had made a suggestion that you had some alternative KPMs that you might even, I think, like to substitute for existing KPMs. I don't know if you'd have time to talk about that in your presentation tomorrow. If not, I would like to invite you to bring Co-Chair Frederick and myself up to speed on those along with Matt.
Co-Chair Witt, we're going to do a little bit of each of those. We're not going to spend a lot of time talking about the substitutes tomorrow, but we would love that conversation.
All right. Thank you very much. Anything further from the subcommittee? All right. Thank you very much. Anything further from the subcommittee?